This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Nelson Mandela and Desmond Tutu are the figures most often coming to mind when we talk about the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. But the film Soft Vengeance tells a story about a lesser-known hero of the struggle, Albie Sachs.
The average white person in South Africa lived a life of complete privilege and were raised under an understanding that they were supreme and it was their land and that Africans were there to serve them.
The way Albie lives his life, Albie gives you faith in being human, in being South African, a white South African man. You look at Albie, you think, Albie is what is possible.
Albie Sachs is a lawyer and a freedom fighter who spent days in prison and years in exile before nearly dying from a car bomb set to kill him. He survived and later returned to South Africa to help draft its new constitution and serve as a justice on the Constitutional Court. The film that tells Albie's story premieres at Full Frame Documentary Film Festival in Durham this Saturday, and we will talk about it on this program right now. Joining us is the producer and director of Soft Vengeance, Abby Ginsberg. Hello, Abby.
Hello, Frank.
And Albie Sachs is with us as well. Hello, Albie.
Hello.
Abby, let me start with you and how you came to know about this story and how you came to meet Albie.
Oh, that goes back a long way. I met Albie in the early 70s when he was traveling through the United States trying to gain support for the anti-apartheid movement. And, you know, we remained in touch all those years. And when I was back in South Africa in 2009, it hit me that this was a story that really needed to be told and that possibly I was the person to tell it. So that was kind of the genesis of the film.
Albie, tell me about that. You talked about in that clip that we just heard, you know, the average white citizen of South Africa back in those days was raised with a story. It was a story about privilege and about their superiority. What was it that got you involved in the anti-apartheid movement? How did you become an activist?
I didn't stand a chance. You guys say I didn't stand a chance. I was born into a family with a totally different story. My parents, my mom coming as an infant, my dad age six, fleeing from persecution in Lithuania, the pogroms aimed at the Jews. And growing up in a home, they developed pretty strong anti-racist ideas. As when they were teenagers, they met, they married. Ultimately had my brother and myself as children. And Johnny, my late brother and myself, we grew up in a home. My mom worked for an African leader, a very prominent person, Uncle Moses. We called him, tidy up, Uncle Moses is coming. And it wasn't Moses Cohen or Moses Rabinowitz. It was Moses Kotani. And my dad was the general secretary of the Garment Workers Union in South Africa. So it was there with my mother's milk.
You were first arrested for civil disobedience when you were 17 years old. Tell us about that.
I was a law student at the University of Cape Town, and it was during what we call the Defiance of Unjust Laws campaign. 10,000 black people had voluntarily gone to jail because they refused to carry passes. They sat on a seat marked whites only. They were out in the streets after curfew hour at night without permission, just defying all these terrible apartheid laws that just crippled their lives. And I felt, and a couple of other young white people felt, we've got to join this struggle. This is a struggle of all human beings, not just of black people. So I led a small group into the General Post Office in Cape Town, and we sat down on benches marked non-whites only. We were arrested. It was my first taste of being in jail. And then we come to court, and the magistrate looks at the charge sheet, and he says, oh, I see there's a juvenile here. That was me, 17. And he said, are any of his parents in court? My mom stands up. And he said, I'm sending you home to your mother. It was a big letdown for me. I wanted to be the almost the revolutionary leader of people joining in the non-racial campaign. But that was the beginning of, that was 1952, so that's quite a while back. And a long and, for me, absolutely marvelous journey, and not without setbacks and difficulties, but being part and parcel of a freedom struggle counted as a privilege far greater than any privileges that my white skin had given me.
Well, you did then go home to your mother, continue with your education and become a lawyer, and ultimately did get yourself put in jail. Tell us about the first time you were sent to jail.
You know, it kind of creeps up on you. You're raided, you're placed under restriction orders, and finally that moment you're kind of waiting for, you're actually put in jail, held in solitary confinement. It was called the 90-day law. They could just pick you up off the streets, in my case, as I was about to enter my office practicing as an advocate, and you're stuck in a cube, concrete cube. No access to family, you're not brought before court, and they can keep you there for 90 days and another 90 days and another 90 days, peppering you with questions whenever they want. I refused to answer any questions. I said, bring me before court. I said, tell me what the questions are. And they said, we can't tell you what the questions are until you say you're willing to answer. And I'd say, well, how can I answer if I don't know what the questions are? I held out, but only just. And eventually, after 168 days, I was released as suddenly as I was picked up, with as little reason given for that. I was absolutely overjoyed that I'd survived. I ran right through Cape Town all the way, maybe 10 miles. I'd never run that distance in my life, and flung myself fully clothed into the sea. But inside me, something was crushed, something... I met somebody who'd been imprisoned under Mussolini in Italy years later, Senator, and we were kind of swapping solitary confinement stories. And he said, you know, Albie, you never really get over solitary confinement. And it's true. There's a certain sense of kind of unhappiness that just lodges deep down in my gut. That's been overtaken by other events, but there's still that little repository there.
And you did decide to leave the country at that time, right?
Yes, I had another detention, which was much worse, with sleep deprivation, collapsing on the floor, water being poured on me, lifting me up, prizing my eyes open, banging, shouting, making a lot of noise, lots of silence. And eventually I decided to leave. I went. It was very, very hard to leave. It was like a defeat in a way. But the choice then was either go underground completely, 100%, dedicated to underground resistance, or to leave. And I didn't have the courage, I didn't have the strength, we didn't have the network, and I left and went first to the United Kingdom, to London.
What did you think? Did you think you were leaving the movement when you did that, when you left the country?
Oh, no. I was carrying the movement with me.
Yeah.
And we were very active. Partly I was studying. I did a doctorate at the University of Sussex on the strange creature, the South African judiciary, which on the one hand could be so punctilious and correct and dignified and use language of justice and freedom and fairness. And on the other hand, South Africa was hanging 100 people every year. It was whipping 20, 30, 40,000. A million people were being prosecuted, 1 million for not carrying their documents, producing their documents on demand from the police. People were chucked out of their homes because they were the wrong skin color. People were sent to jail because they kissed somebody of a different skin color. How could these two things coincide in one justice system? So that became my PhD and a book eventually called Justice in South Africa.
Well, I'd like to ask you about that, because it is insidious, isn't it? When you enshrine racism in your legal code and in your criminal justice system, it's hard to see. And then everybody puts on the wig, crosses the T's, dots the I's, and you've got a system that systematically privileges some and disadvantages others. That's a powerful thing, and often difficult, particularly for the privileged to see, I would think.
You know, some people said that judges should all resign because they're giving legitimacy to a manifestly unjust system. We in the struggle didn't want the good guys to resign, and they were only guys then, by the way. Rather let them stay on, maybe not sentence people to death, maybe when you're exposing torture they will give you a chance to lead the evidence and so on. And we were also looking to the future, that one day we would have democracy, and we wanted the experience of decent, honorable judges of whom there weren't many, but there were enough to provide a bit of a tradition which we could incorporate into the new justice system when we ultimately got democracy.
Eventually, you left England and went to Mozambique. Why there? And tell us about the experience in Mozambique.
Mozambique became independent in 1975. It was after the collapse of the dictatorship in Portugal, partly because of the colonial wars, and an organization called FRELIMO, the Front for Liberation of Mozambique, had led the resistance to Portuguese domination, and they were now in office. And they had a very generous, open policy against racism, incorporating everybody willing to work for the development of the new independent country. And I wanted to be back close to South Africa. I wanted to be in African conditions. I wanted to deal with the problems of my part of the world, and I wanted to use my legal skills to help develop a brand new legal system in Mozambique. So that's why I went there.
One of the turning points in the film is a moment when you're called on by the head of the anti-apartheid party in exile, the African National Congress, of course, to advise them about how to handle issues of torture. Tell us about that.
You know, even when I think back, I'm asked to meet Oliver Tambo in his office in Lusaka, and I still remember so vividly. It was a hot day, and he had a rolled-up newspaper, and he was swatting flies. And I really felt there's something incongruous. The president of the National Liberation Movement is swatting flies, and all the time he's speaking to me, he's and hitting another, that's another dead fly. Eventually, very, very polite, asking after my health and the work in Mozambique, he comes, the very African style, the point of asking me there. He said, we've captured many people sent by Pretoria, by apartheid, to destroy the ANC. And they're very serious in what they're trying to do. And we don't have anything in our statutes as to what to do with captured enemy agents. I mean, the ANC was a political party, and I sometimes imagine the Democratic Party having a clause in its constitution what to do with captured Republicans. You know, you just don't get it there. So he said it must be very difficult to find what are the standards that we should use in dealing with them. And in my kind of jaunty, lawyer-like way, I said, well, it's not difficult. There are international legal instruments that say no torture, inhuman or degrading punishment or treatment. He said, we use torture, with a bleak face. We use torture? We're fighting for freedom and we use torture? I was kind of stunned. And it turned out afterwards this had happened in camps in Angola, quite far away from Lusaka. He'd received information that terrible things were happening there. He'd sent people to inquire, and they had reported to him that there was very strong, credible evidence that our people were using torture against these agents. And he asked me, could I help the ANC draft a code of conduct to deal with how to treat captured enemy agents? And we set up what in effect was a whole set of principles of criminal law and criminal procedure and fundamental rights for a liberation movement in exile. I think we're the only movement that's ever done that. And we explicitly said no torture. It wasn't simply the president now making that the ruling for the organization. He wanted the whole movement to be involved. It was discussed. We had a conference. Delegates could give their views. And I remember so vividly standing on the platform, I was presenting the code, and a young guy, a soldier in the ANC, he probably died in the struggle. The chances are he never survived. But he stood up and he said, we are fighting for life. How can we be against life? It was so moving for me.
Well, I think go ahead, please continue.
No, that's what kept us together. It was far more powerful to be united by a common ideal that enabled us to survive Mandela, 27 years in jail, us in exile, being bombed. If it was for something, then if we just were just like another group fighting for power using the same methods that they used. And we decided unanimously, no torture. And the phrase that was put to the conference was, is it possible in extreme situations to use intensive methods of interrogation? And the membership said no. Mm-hmm. And I was absolutely thrilled.
It's one of the
and,
more...
And we,
Well, it's one of the highlights of the film, I think, is to point out that in any freedom struggle, there is, of course, the enemy, those who you are fighting over and against, but then the struggle within the movement for a vision and a way to stay faithful to values. And that's part of this film as well. But because of your work with the African National Congress, the government did eventually identify you and targeted you for elimination. And we have a clip from the film of the man who had planned many of these executions. Let's listen.
The ANC had a fairly strong structure inside Mozambique. The idea then would be to collect as much as possible information, what they are driving, where they stay, what their social habits were, their likes, their dislikes. Then you could put him on the table and it will be discussed. People will make decisions. Who's the, let's say, the best person to be eliminated? Now it's no longer in your hands. And the fact of the matter is he was deemed important enough to take action against him. Otherwise, people would have removed his name a long time ago.
The film is Soft Vengeance. It premieres this Saturday at the Full Frame Documentary Film Festival. It's produced by Abby Ginsberg. It's the story of Albie Sachs. They're both on with me now. Abby, as you reconstructed this story, was it difficult to find all of the characters and the people who played such an important part in this story?
Well, I got a lot of good leads from Albie. And most people, in fact, I think pretty much almost all the people that I contacted and said I wanted to interview agreed to do an interview with me, unless there was some kind of, you know, problem with timing or whatever. You know, the interview with Henry was a complicated interview. And I think it gives the film some of its weight to have the person who was overseeing the bombing actually interviewed in it. And I was actually very grateful that he agreed to be interviewed. He was, as I guess I would say, the least likely person to agree. But, you know, I think he feels like his story is part of Albie's story and he was willing to go on camera with it.
You lost an arm, Albie, as a result of the attempted murder. And you had met Henry twice since. Tell us about those meetings.
I was in my office, which we call my chambers, being a judge. And I get a message from reception, a man says he has an appointment to see you. His name's called Henry, and I said, send him through. And I walked to the security gate, and my heart's going boom, 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 because he'd phoned to say he's the person who organized the placing of the bomb in my car. He's going to the Truth Commission. Am I willing to see him? And I opened the door, and there's Henry. And he's tall and thin like me, younger than myself, and he's looking at me and I'm looking at him, and I see in his eyes, so this is the man I tried to kill, and he can see in my eyes, this is the man who tried to kill me. We didn't even know each other. We hadn't fought. We weren't angry with each other, but he was on that side. I was on this side. I remember we went to my office, and he's striding like a soldier, and I try my best judge's ambulation to slow him down. And we talk, we talk, we talk, we talk, we talk, and eventually I say, Henry, I've got to get on with my work. We stand up, and I say, normally when I say goodbye to someone, I shake their hand. I can't shake your hand. But go to the Truth Commission, tell them what you know. Maybe we'll meet one day. And I remember when he went back to the security gate, he's shuffling along, very, very different. I forgot about him. Getting on with my work comes to the end of the year, going with a friend to a party, and we judges, really, we work hard, 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 and we enjoy our end-of-year parties. And the band is making a lot of sound, and people are dancing, and I hear a voice saying, Albie, Albie. I look around. My God, it's Henry. Apparently, these were filmmakers who were making a film about the one soldier who came to the Truth Commission, and he's beaming, and he comes up to me, and we get into a corner, try and get away from the noise, and he says, and I went to the Truth Commission, and I spoke to Bobby and Sue and Farouk, his first name terms for people who were with me in exile who also could have been victims of the bomb. He's calling me Albie, and I told them everything I knew, and I said, Henry, I've only got your face to say that what you're telling me is the truth. And I put out my hand and I shook his hand.
The Albie is Albie Sachs. He is the subject of the film Soft Vengeance. Albie Sachs, thank you so much for being on the program. The filmmaker is Abby Ginsberg. She's the producer of the film. Soft Vengeance premieres at Full Frame this Saturday, April 5th. You can find out more information at our website, stateofthings.org. Coming up, minor league baseball in North Carolina. Stay tuned.